architectural science fiction whose intention was to represent the future in manifest form in the present. I mean, I don't want, it's not a formula I particularly believe in, but this is what it was. At the same time, it also attempted to generate an architecture, because one very strong argument that Stalinists had against constructivist architecture was that it was very peculiar that the Russians had had a revolution, the West had not had a revolution, and still the architecture of the West and Russian Soviet architecture looked exactly the same. So something must be wrong there. So they wanted also to develop a unique architecture, and one of the ways of doing it was kind of through the extrapolation of folkloric forms in the Soviet Union and kind of their inflation and enlargement to a colossal and megalomaniac scale of these skyscrapers, so that at the same time this architecture could claim to be of a totally new order, but be based on elements that were existing in the context. This is kind of one of the most brilliant results of that period, the Moscow subway system. At the same time, painting also became far less adventurous and really the worst kind of academic literalness, as this man painting the entrance of Lenin's mausoleum. Anyway, in 1930, through these events, something happened, something snapped in the middle, and after all the relentless rectilinearity, suddenly everything comes here, as you can see, went soft, in a sense. And in any case, became different. And the difference is very apparent in the first housing scheme we did only 1 year after Magnitogorsk, which rather than a grid and with regular infill, is a series of 60 autonomous and totally different and relentlessly varied villas, of which this is one. And suddenly, kind of through the insistence of Stalinism, we have a very noticeable move away from the conceptual architecture and a certain concentration on the physical, physicality or the physique of the forms. Here we have this kind of strange wriggle to get into the building. When, but still, I think, an extremely handsome building. And I now want to discuss one major project in detail, which I think represents Leonidas at the peak of his powers, in the sense that it has and contains all the conceptual strength and force that the earlier work had, but now, in a way, stimulated by Stalinism or forced by Stalinism as a kind of self-critique, it also engages a whole series of other issues, such as context, history, ornament, that are now becoming more and more important here. But I would suggest to you that it is done in this case at such a superior level that all the present postmodern architecture is definitely challenged with. It was a project for a ministry of heavy industry on Red Square in Moscow. And for its understanding, I have to really explain the context in detail. This is the plan of the Kremlin. In the Kremlin, there's one black building which will have a major impact of the building. This is Red Square with Lenin's mausoleum. This is St. Basil's Cathedral. Here's the river. This is the black rectangle. It's the Bolshoi, neoclassical Bolshoi Theater, which is black, as we shall see later for important reasons. And this whole area, I just will show you beginning from here, from a view here. So here we have the Kremlin, which is really a paralleled architectural spectacle of its violent skyline. Then a sloping up to Red Square. Here is St. Basil's Cathedral. Here is St. Basil's Cathedral with a slope, and there to the left Red Square. And the side opposite the Kremlin defined by Boom, which is a colossal galleria. Now we stand on the north side of Red Square, looking down to the river. So again, St. Basil's, the walls of the Kremlin, and here Lenin's mausoleum with its perpetual line of 4 miles of fortunate Soviet citizens. And here there is an insert in the Galleria of Gurm. So these are essentially the components with which Leonidov has to deal. And here is a view again of the skyline of the Kremlin, with this building is the only one that was black on the plan, so that is apparently of particular importance for Leonidov. Now here we have a model of the scheme. The scheme consists of two parallel blocks, here and here. Sorry, I should also say that this whole zone is a kind of slum area. So Leonidov first put a kind of version of Central Park in New York there, which was kinked, including its kind of transverse rock, and here it puts its building. Two parallel slabs, and then a collection of three towers between the slabs. Here, so two parallel slabs, one here, one there, and then in this black, three towers. This slab facing Red Square is in fact a series of tribunes that is in a sense a continuation of Red Square, so that from here this became in its entirety a kind of grandstand from which the spectacles of Red Square could be followed. And here we have a plan of the scheme. This is the parallel long building on the park. This is the building on Red Square. And here we have the plans of the three towers. One is rectangular, one is round, and one is triangular. And now we will kind of see how, through the manipulation of these three forms, Leonidov establishes a meaning for relationship with the past. For him, the rectangle was the form of the past, and the future architecture he predicted would consist of more and more curves. In other words, the use of the curve was the characteristic of architecture in the future. Also, of course, stone is a traditional material, and glass a modern material, certainly in the 30s, when this was built. Now, this tower is rectangular and stone, so it is, in a sense, twice traditional. Then the second tower is a mixture of rectangular elements in stone and curved elevations in glass. So it's kind of half traditional, half modern. The third tower is round both in plan and in section and entirely constructed in glass. So it's a kind of triple modern. So what we have here is that if we stand with our back to the Kremlin, in a sense, a project within which the future unfolds itself. Because here we stand, we see only the traditional tower, we see the second tower, which is slightly more modern, and the future that is obscured by the volume of this building is reflected here in the curve of the half-modern, half-traditional building. So here we have this kind of condition. So it's extremely difficult to focus this projector. Where this part of the rectangular tower is clad in exactly the kind of stone of the Kremlin as an explicit reference. This one in kind of whiter stone, newer, and then the kind of sheet of glass, and here barely visible the glass tower that was built of glass, black glass brick. And out of this black glass brick, there are strange growths, like toadstools, that were also gilded. So here we see, again, kind of, apart from involving this whole building within a kind of weaving it kind of within the context, the visual context and the kind of historical context of the complex, there are also, again, not so much quotations of the domes, but equivalents or analogs often these gilded platforms. And here, stainless steel silver spires that glisten violently in the center. And here, so this is kind of talking about the large scale, and then the building is also equipped with several elements that in a way engage it or anchor it in the small scale of Moscow. Most importantly, this club, which is exactly the same height as St. Basil's Cathedral, and painted, as we shall see later, in a color scheme that also mirrors or echoes the color scheme of this thing. So we have, at the same time, a kind of concern for the large scale and the small scale. Next. And here you see why the Bolshoi Theater was blacked out on the original plan, because this club is exactly on the line between the Bolshoi Theater and St. Basil's, and again is engages this element also from a similar scale. This kind of this developing or growing modernity within a single scheme is also true of this tower, where from the traditional confines of the stone part escapes the glass top. Which you see here colors. So there was this kind of redness of the Kremlin colors with the violent green of the curtain wall escaping at the last possible moment. Here we have the explication of these toadstools. They connect every time with double height lobbies or cafeterias in the building. And here we have a vision of the office workers enjoying the view of Moscow sitting on these tribute. Here, this is the only kind of remaining part of the model, which shows the colors of the intended bird. And now, finally, we have one drawing that kind of more than any other explication really demonstrates and proves the concept of this thing. In the kind of very intense and dense context of the Kremlin and the kind of the mythological core of Moscow, with all its violent architectural monuments, looks as if a kind of mysterious communist fertilizer has been applied, which suddenly caused a new leap scale and a new accelerated growth. But it is also clear from all those elements that the growth is really within an extrapolation of the same vocabulary, and really extremely in spite of its scale, or maybe even through its scale, and there is kind of the suggestion of a curve here, an extremely respectable modern addition to a historical cityscape. And here again, in this drawing, that kind of explicit reference of one thing growing out of another is completely clinched. Anyway, so we now enter, or with the previous project, we enter the unknown phase of Leonidas' work. The official version of his life is that he really performed from 25 to 30. But what we discovered is that actually, by going several times to Moscow, that actually his life had a completely unknown extension, even under Stalinism, and that actually in the late 30s, from 1937 to 1939, he was working at the Crimea, in the south of Russia on the Black Sea, with a team of other architects to develop for the Soviet state an enormous stretch of at least 100 miles long into a kind of communist Riviera. So here we have a kind of an image of Leonid at work there, obviously a kind of happy and strong man. And here we have some of our kind of earliest discoveries of those projects. The Crimea is really a series of mountain, very agitated terrain, of very vicious mountain ranges that suddenly drop into the sea. So there's a very violent kind of fingers of the mountains that reach the sea. And in this drawing, one can see some of the kind of intentions of the scheme. It was, they intended, I think it's even clear in this one, what they intended to do. And of course, the quality of these slides is totally determined by their by the fact that they were hardly preserved, well preserved. But if the concept of the scheme is to create a continuous boulevard along the beach to equip that boulevard at kind of strategic locations with social events like fountains, dressing rooms, little restaurants, and then to build from that boulevard and to tie from that boulevard certain kind of episodes that would exploit events in nature and events in the landscape. And as we were doing this, kind of we became closer and closer in finding the real evidence of the activity of the Inuit in the late 30s, which was of course a very exciting thing to discover. And also we discovered that this scheme had been really elaborated in complete detail, and actually also that it was intended to be built, and not only the fact that the war interfered made it aborted the whole situation. So here we see the thing, the boulevard, these kind of pergolas or little monuments, little excavations kind of created in the mountains, a great sensitivity and virtuosity of exploiting moments in nature. And then we discovered in the former, in the house of Leonidov, which in itself is an apartment in a modern block, in the former apartment of the man, in the possession of his widow, who is here on the telephone, an amazing series of paintings and of drawings where this that represented this scheme. And what is also amazing is that this scheme is then represented in a series of icons. Where, so suddenly, kind of under the pressure of Stalinism, which is with its insistence that that art should return to tradition or be a version of tradition, suddenly this knowledge that seemed very ill-timed and ill-appropriate becomes, on the contrary, extremely adequate and extremely desirable as a form of architectural expression. So what we found is three enormous wooden panels painted by Leonidov to represent this whole project for a coastline, with the mountains, monuments, and kind of complexes, sanatoria, hospitals, and the continuous coastline. And I will show, this is a kind of Luxembourg that obviously brought on there. This is a kind of grandstand carved out in the mountains, and here rather faintly you see a series of umbrellas. And I just want to show you the plans existed, or rather shreds or fragments of plans that really represent all this very accurately. But here, this grandstand carved out in the mountains, here the series of umbrellas, and here another fountain. So basically, everything which we thought was totally ill-assorted evidence did fit together. And we also see how, through the sudden availability of all historical sites, and the fact styles, and the fact that the site was in itself almost Asia, and therefore had the kind of legitimate exotic characters, Leonidov's fantasy could somehow circumnavigate the ugliness of Stalinism, or use the ugliness of Stalinism for its own purposes through equipping this whole zone as a kind of magical belt. This very exotic architecture with a boulevard, a kind of entrance to a sanatorium, steps, and a kind of temple with beyond the dormitories, a fountain on the coast with a kind of transplantation of the Tuscan landscape. And here, for instance, the model just painted with this there. Then, connecting all the complexes in the mountains were very interesting networks of footpaths. And here we see just kind of an episode of structures built in the mountains, a mixture of modern and kind of traditional or eclectic, eclecticism implanted in a part. Here a series of umbrellas that, if it started to rain, would unfold automatically. And finally, here a complex of a museum on top of a hill that was, and the hill was turned into a red hill by planting a top with, its top with red flowers, with a bridge going from the top to another hilltop that was planted with blue flowers, so that there was a red and a blue hill with a bridge between them, and then an amphitheater excavated from the mountain again. This was a museum, a place for performance, and a place for larger performances. And then this project was again represented in another colossal icon that was as big as this one, and this was the only original photograph we could find, where here we see the coastline again, a series of paths that go up the hill, and then here kind of experimental of the hilltop, the bridge, and the music pavilion and the amphitheater. And here then is the evidence of such a painting. And again, I think that this kind of visual material is the most effective contradiction to the kind of present claims of the puritanism of modernism and of everything that is wrong with modernism, because after all, this was produced in the space of 10 years by a young modern architect. Be it in the extremely exceptional and arduous and agonizing conditions, but nevertheless. So here, to museum, the kind of hilltop with strange seats carved out, the performance theater for, I think, for music, spectacle, and sport. Always the kind of problematic invention, and then the amphitheater. Now, of this whole scheme, as I said, it was supposed to be actually built, but only a tiny fragment was realized by Leonido, which is also the last thing, the only thing he ever built in his life. Here at the foot of a sanatorium, he kind of landscaped or architecturized the whole mountain slope going toward the sea, and only this gives you a kind of sense of what this architecture might have been. So all kind of episodes that have cultural functions or just rest functions. With the quotations of non-existent historical past. Anyway, as the Soviet state was likely to do, it sent those citizens it thought least desirable to the front line in the Second World War. And one of those citizens was Leonido, who received a bullet in the middle of his head in 1944 and needed 2 years to recuperate of that wound. This is the first house he designed after his... And from that moment starts Leonido's life really becomes a true tragedy, because he was by the Soviets not allowed to perform his profession of architect any longer. He was forced in all kinds of menial job, and as the now contemporary Soviet euphemism has it, he only exercised architecture as his hobby. But of course, they have to be very sarcastic about that denomination. So, as a hobby, he only did one more project, which is a project for the United Nations, which, with a kind of great foresight for the forces that would later develop, he placed in an island in the Indian Ocean, and which really is a kind of world's fair, where every nation would build its own pavilion. I think it's actually inspired on the 39 World's Fair in New York, the tribe in the perisphere, and with this big administrative building, and as its central feature, an enormous tent-like structure where representatives of mankind would meet and discuss peace and never stop before peace had been reached. And the floating and hovering above it is the kind of return to this kind of first statement of Leonido, and the one which I thought was the most essential to understanding him. There is this gilded room suspended or captive in cables, And the story was that when once universal peace had been reached, the cables would be cut, the balloon would become a planet, and appear and disappear on the horizon, and whenever it appeared, always trigger festive events. So, apart from this main complex, the whole island was turned into a kind of modern-day version of Easter Island, where all the aborted monuments of the 20th century were realized retroactively, and were also each part of the, this is the administration building, looking at the building below, and where each part of its territory was equipped with kind of poetic totems that would trigger human emotions. Here, the tent, another kind of study for the entrance in the tent, and strange combination of concrete and curtain wall, expressionistic forms, another version of the tent. And then here, the landscape with peaks, the balloon, and for instance, Dublin's monument to the Fifth International, realized to undo its neglect. And then there would be this totemistic outpost watching over mankind, and or some obelisks that grow out of the landscape. And here the whole thing would be Isa and the enigmatic figures. Anyway, that was what he did as a hobby. He was forced by the Soviet government to design decoration for Stalin's buildings. This is a study for a decoration of the fireplace. And even later, he had to work to paint panels for the 58 World's Fair in Brussels. Then somebody took mercy on him. Some influential friends took mercy on him and thought that it was really a scandalous waste to use talent like that only for the for exhibition panels. And as a sign of this mercy, he was allowed to become the second assistant model maker in the School of Architecture, where he had once been the star student. And he was building there, kind of, as a second assistant model maker, the Stalinist skyscrapers that the students had to design. His reputation had, at the same time, a kind of underground reputation, to the extent that the librarian of the school approached Leonidov's son, asking him whether he could help her collect his father's work. And the son was a student there, and the son was so embarrassed and so ashamed and so outraged by the situation that he didn't even dare to say that his father was working in the same building as a second assistant model maker, maybe the greatest architect the century had known. And in 1956, Leonidov had a heart attack on the steps of the same school going to work. Serious, earnest attempts that had a high degree of viability and that were intended to be realized and used, and that if they had been realized, would certainly have been used and would have offered extremely desirable conditions. Just as Manhattan, as you may know, also exists and also offers a series of very desirable and necessary forms of accommodation for the human race. And actually the thing that combines the two things is maybe a kind of campaign on my part to the kind of too easy definition of what absurdity is or what fiction is in architecture, because both Manhattan exist and maybe those words are totally serious and totally viable in my In other words, it's a campaign or to be a creature from a crusade against the easy tagging of architecture, with fantastic architecture, visual architecture, if, as we hope we have seen, it is actually extremely precise, functional, usable. I'm pulling out of I'm opening an office.
In one of the projects you described, I don't remember the name, but it had a spherical theater and it had a projector that was to project messages and so on the cloud. You gave quite a full description of how it was intended to be used. And yet you also said that this architect was only written about 100 words. And certainly the things that you described weren't shown in the drawings.
What do you want to know?
Well, where did the information come from?
He described it in 50 words. he really did with extreme economy. He said, use this material that, location there. It really is a devastating economy. And I'm not being facetious, but with compared to him, all of us, including myself, look like hopelessly addicted to words and hopelessly imprecise and even inarticulate. So of course we did a lot of research. I should also say that this work is a collaboration between myself and a friend of mine, Gerrit Oorthuis, and that we did everything together, that we collected the material together. And basically we've been, I think now, 12 times to Moscow, so it is a kind of an operation of retrieving as much as possible from the projects and the materials where we can find. We've talked to the widow, to the son, to all his former colleagues, etc. So it's a reconstruction.